Pippin, and welcome back to our UFO program.
In late December 1980, a series of reported sightings of unexplained lights and unidentified craft landings occurred in Rendlesham Forest, Suffolk. The two incidents took place in the vicinity of two former military bases, RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge, which at the time were being used by the American Air Force. On the 26th of December, military personnel witnessed strange lights in the forest. Thinking an aircraft might have crashed, they went to investigate. It's reported that what they found was a small triangular-shaped metal craft with strange markings. 2 days later, the deputy base commander and a small group of men witnessed other strange lights through the forest trees, including a red sun-like light which moved about and pulsed. Despite witness accounts, the MOD did not investigate any further, as they didn't believe it was a threat to national security.
That's a soundbite that we lifted off of this morning, the TV show, the BBC. And the reason I played it is they pretty well cover the events of Rendlesham, and whether or not they got them all right or not, we'll talk about that with Peter and Larry Warren. Peter Robbins, of course, both of them are on the line, and it's interesting. I'll bring them both on here in a moment. Peter I've known quite well, and I just found out during the break that Larry Warren stopped one time in Las Vegas while I was doing a show and introduced himself. And as I said earlier, that I had never met him in person, so I was in error. He said, well, it was a pretty brief conversation. Larry Warren, is that about the way it had happened?
It was down in Laughlin, and you were dealing
with... Oh, in Laughlin, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
At those great conferences that are not there now, and... I walked by, and I think Nick went.
Yeah, I was always parked out there in the middle of the lobby with
Absolutely.
Everybody.
Yeah, and I went by, and I just said hi to you, and I sat and listened to you interview someone. I was about 4 feet from you, but you were doing your work.
Yeah.
So fair play. There's a lot of people at those things.
Yes, that's true, and Larry Warren, it's great to meet you in person again on the phone, I guess, this time, but at least now I'm concentrating on talking to you instead of doing an interview with someplace, but I'm glad you came by that time. We had a lot of fun at Laughlin.
They were the
with all of those UFO Congress things, and they're going pretty well in Phoenix. Peter Robbins, you were in Phoenix the last time they had the last one, the UFO Congress. It goes pretty well there too, huh?
I was. It was the second year, of course, that they had it in Phoenix, and I think they've made the transition very well. It was well organized, well attended, had a lot of fun, a lot of good speakers, and it's nice being back in Arizona.
Now you, you're at a party right now.
It doesn't sound like it.
You're back in the bedroom or something. Tell us what's happening there. Is that your nephew that graduated?
My nephew graduated from Cornell yesterday with a BFA in History and American Studies. I couldn't be prouder of him. And for anybody on Facebook, just go to my Facebook page to see some pictures of the graduation. And Cornell, of course, is a huge and highly respected school, but they had almost 5,000 students graduating with bachelor's and master's and doctorates. So the first part of the event yesterday was held in a full football stadium. Pretty intense.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. 5,000 graduates, wow.
I'm proud of that boy, too. I've known him, David, since he was just a little peanut there. And, well, he isn't now, but that's great, and congratulations to him.
You know, yeah, I already gave him your congratulations, Larry, and they're all outside having a grand time. The weather here in central New York State is hot but beautiful. Sun is setting over Lake Cayuga, and all is well.
Well, it's
okay,
warm. We've got warm weather in England, too. Good, finally.
Yeah. What's it like in England this time of year? Does it get up to the 90s like here?
Well, it's hitting the 80s, and that's a lot for the UK, and it's only in the last week. And so it's fried out, people, because our infrastructure here isn't really designed for really warm weather. And so now it's about 3 days in, it's taking people out, because you won't find air conditioning in most houses. has, we never need it. You need your heat on most of the year up in the north here. But we've had great weather. And because it's been great, it will probably end tomorrow, and that's our summer, 3 days. That's all we get.
Well, Joe, our producer for IRN for Inception Radio, he's in Chicago. He's just telling me before we started the show that it's 95 degrees there.
You guys can keep that over there. Keep that there.
Here in Oklahoma, it's in the 80s, so it's that time of year, Memorial Day in the States, as you know, Larry and Peter.
Happy Memorial Day to everybody over there. We have Remembrance Day over here in the UK, and if you're a Yankee over this way, you sometimes miss the, like Mother's Days are at different times of the two different months and from the States, and you kind of get confused after many years. I've been here a long time now.
You're actually an American-born person, right? Where did you live here before you went to
America? I was born in New York City and grew up in the East Coast and New York State and Connecticut and lived in the city and all over the place. And I've been over here since 2000. And my son's English, and I live about a mile from John Lennon's house, and Ringo's maybe a mile down the road, and George and Paul, it's all South Liverpool, so that's where those boys came from, and so I'm right in the footprints of all that. Penny Lane's just a little bit down the road, and it's weird, you take it for granted after a while, but you're right in the heart of it, where those four guys, five guys, six guys, whatever, changed the world, and they came from right here, and it's a great town.
Peter, we haven't mentioned you guys' book yet. Larry Warren and Peter Robbins wrote one hell of a book, and it's a big and well-detailed. And it's Peter, is there anything that's outdated in that book? I mean, it seems to me like you guys had it pretty much right on from the first.
Well, we will remain very proud of that book for the rest of our lives. And I think, as you know, Jerry, it was republished 7 years ago in 2005 on the actual 25th anniversary of the events of December 1980. And it's now comes to almost 540 pages. For any of you listeners that are not familiar with it, the title is Left at East Gate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation.
And, Larry, when you first met Peter, he told me one time he saw you at a conference or something. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That was 87, and it was Washington, D.C., at the American University. And I, MUFON, that group there, asked me to do a paper for them. And, I'm not a researcher. I just got up and said what I said. And I write about that in our book. But I had begun the book a year before, the idea for it, the title, et cetera. And it was, Whitley Strieber that told me when he was working at Communion, and I'd been misrepresented in a book or two by that point, because I've been public since, it's my 29th year since I went public with it. And so we said, you should write your own. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know how you go about that. So the title was the first thing that came to me. And I knew immediately I needed to get someone else involved in this, because I'm not a trained writer in any sense. And I just write like I speak, And then a year later, I got at this conference, and I heard this fella speaking in a panel of abduction, and Whitley was on that, actually. And Bud Hopkins maybe was there, and a lot of those people, Dave Jacobs. And this fella came out in the hallway, and it's how a lot of these weird things in this short life fall together. And I just looked at this guy, and I said, oh, you know, I dug what you said in there, because Peter just kind of evened out a few things. I forget what he said, but it made a lot of sense on whatever it was. And I just said, man, this guy, I just got to talk to him. And And that's where it started, and that's a billion years ago. Who knew? He didn't know what he was getting into, but I knew. I said, after I met him the next week in the city, and I said, you know, this guy's got a, you know, I went down, bought him a lot of stuff, and, you know, I said, you know, would you consider co-authoring a book?
And, well, Peter, Larry's version pretty much gels with yours, so.
Also.
And you had a very interesting reaction about seeing him the first time, just like he did you. Kind of chemically, I guess it came together.
Yeah, you know, Jerry, in the field of serious UFO studies, there are an awful lot of people that claim certain things that there's no way of absolutely confirming 110%, and a number of them, some of the more colorful ones say, you know, when I was in the military, I was privy to information, or I saw this, or this happened to me. And of all the people I had ever heard make claims and things, I'll tell you what, Larry was the real deal for me. And I was so caught up in his talk that I just had to hear more of this. And as he said, when we met in the hallway, we both had our own agendas. Larry was to find somebody to work on, to write this book with him. Mine was to do an interview with this guy, and I was really pleased that he not only agreed to do it, but he came down to New York to my apartment the following weekend. And I recorded, I think, the greatest interview I had ever done at that point, and late in Sunday afternoon, he told me how what he really was looking for, and all I could think of was, wow, you know, write a book. That's very exciting. And, you know, it'll take a year or two. We'll spend a couple of $1,000s. It'll be obviously a huge bestseller. We'll be rich and famous. You know, George Clooney, he wasn't around yet, but, you know, we'd have a great movie being made of it, and the rest of our life would be Easy Street. Well, I got that part wrong. And 10 years later.
Well, you got a little dose of reality of the publishing business, but it's actually been a big success, this book has.
Well, again, we're very proud of it, and
the best part for me when you do a book on, or any book, and if I never do another, was when we were in Philly, I think, in 97. And we did that gig with Carl Bernstein from Watergate, and all the President's Men. And he said, we popped that first case of the book, just got delivered to us. And, you know, you talk about this thing for 9.5, 10 years, which it took us to do it, and because there's no guarantees you're ever going to get publishers. And we had real life, a divorce in the middle of it with me, and all kinds of just about every darn thing that you can imagine. And just I've never matched that thrill of opening that box, and I always and pulling that book out. And I've never quite matched that, you know. And after a while, then when it was done, I'm like, oh God, this is too personal. I don't want anyone to read it. It was the weirdest dynamic. And I would not change. We've had maybe not financially, but I mean, it was never set out to do that. And we spent far more money than we'll ever expected to see. And but the book was designed to do one thing. It was kind of an apology to my ex-wife. It was an explanation to my family. It was this poor guy on the other end of the line, Peter, went through. He got sucked into the mail being open and all kind of nefarious things going on. He had his good name. Well, lately, this has gone on with there's just this unholy union of certain people around this thing. It's a very toxic, nasty event, chain of events. There's nothing new agey and peaceful about Rendlesham and happy and hobby-like. There's nothing about that. Our book was designed to do one thing, is to really set things right with my family and people I may have damaged through my damage from there and what they did to us after the fact. Which is established, and then, but it was to get people to talk. It was to open up a dialogue. It was the first book by someone who was a witness, and I was a witness to what I say. Now, do I have a perception of it that is inaccurate? There was a lot of mind control. I find it fascinating. Everything I've said, and I don't know what this stuff was. I was in the forest. What planet or dimension or from the future? Our book deals more with those things are great for speculation. It gets you nowhere, really. We'll know when we're dead. Our book is an excellent tool to see abuse of power and how this issue is suppressed and covered up. And I put my name to it. Here I am. I'm from a good family. I won't have my family's name dragged through the mud at all, or my co-authors. And we're very proud of it. We did it. We caused a lot of hell because we did it and shook up a lot of people and at high levels. And we know that because I lost my passport for a while. And it took a former U.S. Attorney General named Ramsey Clark under two presidents, thanks to Peter knowing him or knowing people that knew him, and they got it back. Now, they don't do that to people that aren't telling it straight. So we've been down our road. We've earned that badge. And we're very proud of it. And it's done what it was set out to do, was to get people engaged, to talk, to get witnesses to come out. And I think, as the SAS, Special Air Service, would say, job done. We did that.
Yeah, Peter, I want to give both of you a chance on this show to really cover some things that you want to get out. And so I don't want to dominate everything because I respect both of you. Both of you a hell of a lot, as you know. And so ultimately, before this interview is over, we're going to let Larry give his story the way he wants to tell it. But before we do that, Peter, I think we need to mention this conference coming up. It's coming up there on the 17th. And before that, you're going over to France. What are you doing over there?
Well, believe it or not, I'm giving talks on the Rendlesham Forest incident to groups in Bordeaux and Toulouse, and I've been signed on to do some episodes of a UFO documentary show. I'll be working in Paris for a couple of days, so I'll be warming up in France on this most important subject, and then heading over to London on the 10th, about a week before the conference. And really looking forward to it. And for any of your listeners in the UK, in Europe, anybody in the States that can join us, this is going to be a very special event. As Jerry has said, it's going to be on Sunday, June 17th, and it's going to run for more than 12 hours. And it's certainly not just Larry and I, and Larry will be master of ceremonies and joining me when I give my talk, which will not just cover some of the most important material that we were able to unearth, but it will be a respectful review of some of the other claims and explanations and a certain amount of really the controversy that still rages around this amazing subject.
Yeah, you mentioned raging controversy. You and I have had a lot of experience with people in Roswell, and it seems to me that, Peter, and Larry, you can chime in on this if you want to, it seems to me that there's just a lot of friction going on that's unnecessary at Rendlesham, and maybe it's orchestrated. Have you guys thought about that?
That's the word.
We have.
My friend, that is the word, man. I'll tell you, Jerry, dead on, mate, dead on.
Yep.
Two writers, they say, in Liverpool. It can be nothing other than that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I have no problem agreeing with Larry here, and anybody that knows me knows I'm not the kind of person that jumps the gun or sees conspiracies behind every tree, but the attack that was quite sustained for some months on Larry and our book and myself to a degree, and then stopped almost dead a few months back, was, I'm as sure as I can be, that it wasn't just the invention of two of the other witnesses who have had their differences with us. Let's remember it this way. Jerry, you remember on the 50th anniversary of Roswell in 97, the Air Force issued a report as big as the New York City phone book. It was quite a few hundred pages I think it was called Roswell Case Closed. And it was full of absolute nonsense about the crash dummies, which, of course, they didn't use till 5 years later. And it got me thinking, you know, here they were half a century after the event, and there was still such a push to belittle, to confound, to make fun of the story. 31.5 years later, the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident story is still causing a lot of problems in high places. And the idea of introducing the notion that it was only a psychological operation or that it was time travelers from our future or, I think in part are manifestations of a program to make people look at a little shiny object and look away from the real evidence of a truly extraordinary event, very well documented by Larry and I and others. And I'll be addressing that in no uncertain terms on the 17th of June.
Yeah, now Larry mentioned mind control a little earlier. And a lot of people kind of look at you a little strange when you say that. But I've had experiences, as you know, doing these kind of shows over several decades. And somebody's tampering with somebody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's something going on.
They took after the fact of these events, and everyone that comes out now and talks about it, and I was the first to say that, you know, and then I had to explore certain things and found out that it was even more clinical than some weird, you know, there were insertions in there. And way back, and then. But then I come to find out, and I look at things, and I think, my view now, I couldn't sum up better than what Peter just did, but my view now is that some of us were put in place as early as the summer of 1980. They were preparing us to be there, and I think there was some kind of, my view on the whole thing, there was some kind of experimentation going on to bring this phenomena, condense it into one area, to observe it, to observe real stuff, whatever it is, to observe, see, document from afar where people aren't aware. And I think a number of us, I wasn't even supposed to be on that darn base. And all these, and people say, why isn't that in the book? And I just didn't register with me then. I was like, well, that doesn't make sense. So I'll walk away from it. But I had the easiest time in basic training, the easiest time in the police academy. It's like being in jail. I was allowed in basic training to go out to San Antonio with my father for dinner. You don't do that. I did. You have the wing commander of our base, Gordon Williams, who doesn't know anything or remember anything, come to, handle my discharge personally, and the wing commander doesn't even do that. He personally did that. And then you have, when in fact we were all given not sodium pentothal, like one of the other ones talk about, it was sodium amethyl. And how I know is because myself, and I wouldn't say this if I didn't have a person of this caliber, and I wish they would say something because they were there, because I wanted them there. I was approached in Laughlin. And Jerry, and I think you would have been at that same event. It was the last Laughlin conference they ever had. And I filled in and spoke at the end of it. But before that, I was approached by a retired four-star general who went to West Point with Gordon Williams, lifelong friends, and a female woman who was the only CIA agent who was a POW during the Vietnam War. She was the only female, I think, POW, as far as I remember. But they had a message for me, and I'm not going to go into it on here. I can't, because Gary, there's a gentleman, Gary Haseltine. He's a CID detective here in Leeds, England, and he's a current CID detective. And, frankly, I couldn't even hear half of the stuff they were laying on me because they brought me some messages. And they were very real. In fact, this general went over my paperwork. I happen to have all this stuff with me because I was going to show it to a friend of mine, Ron, I think. And I happen to have it. And he went over stuff and he said, well, this is why this is. Gordo wouldn't have, you know, he did this because of this. And I was given an apology via these people. Oh, yeah. And then reasons why certain things can't be and spoken about by certain people. And I'm a very open person. I'm not one to, you know, I'm very open. And if I hadn't been, the thing wouldn't have popped when it did in 83. It had to come out. But, boy, it put me back to this whole big program they got called Preserve Destiny. And they have these people picked out. I mean, they go from the military an awful lot. And it's not weird time stuff. I have to say, Georgina Bernay, God rest her soul, and I'm not thrilled with how I was dealt with in the book, but I know why she did, you know, I don't look too great in that book. But her and I were personal friends, and we rectified the issue. She did a good job in that book, very good. And she was on to something very big, beyond the incidents. It was beyond, she identified the program behind the incidents and why certain people were put there. And that all began as far as early as the summer of 1980. I was going to RAF Auchenberry, and I'll just leave it at this, and if anyone knows how the military works, we have a day where your dream sheet comes up, and I'll never forget this day. It was a sunny day, and this guy behind me was in our ranks for the police academy, but his hair, you could judge the new guys. You know, we had short hair. It was just starting to grow out in the academy. And this guy had longer hair. You know, he looked like he'd been in a while, you know, but I'm a naive 19-year-old kid, and you don't think of these things. And this guy came up to me, and they said, Airman Warren, RAF Auchenberry. And I'm like, oh, where's that, you know? And this guy, I tell you, he couldn't have made a beeline for me as I'm leaving the room quick enough. And he goes, Warren, where are you going? Auchenberry. He goes, my girlfriend's there, and, you know, Bentwaters is where I'm going. Do you want to switch assignments? So I'm like, oh, okay. And I'm thinking, you know, it's like I just got out of high school, you know. And so I thought it's like going down to the office and changing your gym class or something, you know. But the government doesn't work like that and at all. Nothing is quick. And within 5 minutes, he went to this thing, and they switched my assignments at this counter. And it was like this big deal. These people were coming up, and like, oop. And they made a mistake there, and I wouldn't have caught on to it. And I was meant to go where I was going, and this guy was a facilitator because a number of us in that flight ended up at Bentwaters, and a number of us ended up involved directly or peripherally with these events, and then the really nasty stuff the intelligence community laid down after. And it's a big story. It should have been in our book, but I did not know it. I didn't want to know it. None of it made sense. And I say, oh, that's too hairy for me, and I just can't deal with that. And that's where I'm at now. I just start to see this stuff was all planned out, and there was no accidents with a majority of the people being in it. Whatever happened, there was no accident. And I do think our command knew, certain ones knew very well what was going on. They knocked this guy, Malcolm Ziegler, who was their chief of security police. That guy couldn't have been a better pal than me, I'll tell you. These people, we were just guided right through and me right out the door to do what I did. There's no doubt in my mind now. But when you're a young, stupid idiot, as young guys are, you know everything, you don't know anything. And in my 50s, I now know. And thanks to those people in Laughlin, and Gary, I hope you're listening and hope you can verify this at some point. You know, I had the big picture kind of given to me a little bit.
We're certainly not going to let this story go away.
It will never go. Like I've always said, you know, you take me out of it and all that, and it will never go away. This one will never. There's too many people involved in it. And, you know, there's problems right now with a certain quarter of it. And perceptions and getting real personal and nasty, not necessarily accurate. And, you know, I don't want to jump on these other guys. You know who I'm talking about. Because they went through stuff. You know, that's the pain I have. Because if you read our book, I speak very highly of these people. And I didn't know them nothing. I don't know any of these guys, a lot of them. There's a lot of good guys. And then there's other guys who, you know, no, we wouldn't have a beer together in real life. But I respect the fact they went through this stuff and they got nailed. But I'll be darned if they're going to, you know, just sweep, particularly my co-author around. I can take it. I'll go face to face with anybody. But this guy, man, he's in there. He did the good work. If he thought I was BS, I passed lie detectors anyway. I have the documents proving my exposure. We have the proof of where one of the sites were for the landings, scientifically proven. But you know what? I think there's a major push right now to really, they want civil war. And when you're having civil war, you're not seeing the big picture, the man behind the curtain, and that's all it's about. I'll shut up now.
Larry has got some stories that are very similar to people that early on, many of them passed away at Roswell now, but these guys get treated pretty badly when they witness something like that, but they don't want to get out. I don't find anything hard to believe at all about what Larry's saying.
The only problem I got, if I can just say real quick, and it's important, I was the first guy to come out and say we had nuclear weapons because we had tactical bombs on the base. And that's too bad because everyone knew it anyway in the surrounding. Our friends that lived near there knew that. Everyone knew it. And it was, that constitutes defense significance if you got unknown objects flying around and shining beams down near these areas or in them or whatever. And you've got all that going on. And, you know, at the end of the day, you've got a couple of these guys that still won't admit that were there. And I've seen other Bentwaters guys and veterans say, yeah, we had nuclear weapons. Of course we did. But there's a couple of them, I'll say there are three, that still go silent because of their oath and their loyalty to the feds, the government. And I respect their service, their career boys and all that. Good for them. But they still won't admit there were nukes. And if they don't admit there are nukes and they're still adhering to some oath, even after the way they got treated like dirt themselves, their own words, and through narco-hypnosis and all kinds of things, well, and houses getting broken, John, all that, and they're still loyal? I'm sorry, man. Look at all these veterans' hospitals, these guys not getting treated well. Over in England, man, they don't even treat the veterans coming back from the war zones here with any respect. They don't do it in the States either. They let these people go on welfare and all that. These are the people we got to be loyal to? I'm sorry, man. I think they got revolution sitting under their fingernails. That's my opinion.
Peter, when we talk about the victims or the witnesses, what they technically are, and they're victims simply because they start talking.
Yep.
They get treated pretty raw. You've seen this over and over and over again.
Yeah,
they don't seem to have any conscience about it at all.
No,
they just destroy lives.
Yes,
and
conscience has nothing to do with it. And Jerry, for anybody in the audience that doesn't know, you know, your great outspoken broadcast and your voice as a person in the media relative to the Roswell story has meant an awful lot to a lot of the people that were involved there. And two of our friends and colleagues, that's Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, wrote an outstanding book called Witness to Roswell. And it's the best documented book probably that will ever be written, where they were able to interview over the past 20, 25 years dozens and dozens of individuals that were directly or indirectly involved in these events, or their siblings or widows or what have you. And the stories that emerge there are absolutely hair-raising. The threats, literally threats of death against people in 1947, including children, by an arm of the United States government to keep them terrified and quiet, in some ways we have seen replicated, although some of it's been a bit more sophisticated and handled in a more hidden hand kind of way, with Rendlesham witnesses as well. Also, witnesses turned against other witnesses, and this goes back several decades now. I've documented it in a way that I've never really talked about, but will in the middle of next month. A lot of courage. Remember all these guys that Larry was with, they were mostly teenagers, and they had joined the service for all the right old-fashioned reasons. If you read the book, you find that Larry's enlisting in the Air Force is superimposed on the Iranian hostage crisis. Now we're a generation after Vietnam. It's more acceptable for young men to, you know, join up again, unlike my generation. And I resisted going into the military with mixed feelings at the height of Vietnam. I thought it was a wrong war. I still feel it was a wrong war. I hold my brothers who were there in extremely high regard, and that's a totally separate issue. But these guys had joined to serve their country, and the way they were treated was shameless. In fact, Larry and I, on our very first trip over, February of 1988, I had the absolute crap scared out of me. Larry and I had our own multiple UFO event, not six miles from the site of his original event, our very first night of our very first visit. And I can't even tell you how many times I've been back there now. 50? I don't know. I've been back to that field and the areas where it happened dozens of times over the decades. And it took me quite a few months for that fear to kind of mutate into something that Larry had been carrying around from the get-go, which was a lot of righteous anger about the way he and other good men and women had been treated. And at that point where I got angry, the fear dissipated and I was in for the long haul. And that was 25 years ago. I can hardly believe it now. I mean, my relationship with Larry is longer than any woman I've ever been with. God help me. I mean, I should have been married twice by now.
I have been, unsuccessfully.
Well, I can identify with that, too.
Not to each other, though. Certain parties writing a book, they'd love that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but...
You mentioned something. You need to give me a little thumbnail about this UFO experience you had. I mean, give me a little brief experience before we go let that just pass by.
Yeah, on the very first night of our very first visit there, Larry and I walked out to the base. It was a little more than a mile from where we were staying in the village of Ike. And Larry walked me on to the base. There are parts of base that open to the public, and he basically walked me through part of the history of his time on the base, of the events in question. It was amazing. We spoke to a security cop who verified a lot of what Larry had originally told me. We left the base about 9:30 at night. It was very dark, no ambient light, a temperate night. I was really thrilled when Larry told me it was a night very much like his experience. And about 9:30 precisely, I saw a elliptical-shaped object over the Rendlesham Forest, and I pointed it out to him as I snapped on one of the two tape recorders I had with me. And for the next hour and a half, we watched no less than several dozen anomalous objects, as small as little star-shaped things in the sky, zigzagging around, to disc-shaped objects, to finally something that dropped into the woods and lit it up like there was a city back there, and then something that lit up at the end of the field we were standing at. I went into shock, I know that. And it was a very, very emotional experience for me. It was all recorded as it was happening.
And I ran after it, man, remember.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
you grabbed me, you got all mad, man. I went to kick its rear end. That was bad,
yeah,
man.
I was afraid we were going to end up on Mars that night. I asked them to stop.
This happened.
Yeah. The entire episode that we experienced was audio tape recorded. And recently, Larry and I allowed those tape recordings, our original recordings, to be subject to a full voice stress analysis series of tests. They came up absolutely unquestioned as real. And that changed my life that night. I tell you what, I've been working on this.
I'd sure like to hear those recordings.
Well,
what's going to happen to those recordings? Are you going to release them as something? I'll play them if you'll get them to me.
I'll tell you what, though, at some future time, I'm sure it'll be okay with Larry. We'll come back and we'll play parts of those recordings on your show.
There's a lot of language on that, though.
you have to go through that. There is a little bit of salty language. You got to have a beeper button.
We can beep that out. So we'll talk about that.
Well, you know, Jerry, you'll be beeping the whole thing.
Now that the news is out, everybody else is going to try to get those from you. Remember, you promised me.
Yeah, Pete, you come on and play him for Jerry, man. You do that.
I think between the two of us, we probably smoked about 20 packs of cigarettes that night while watching. We didn't stop. And I still haven't recovered from that.
Well, things are still happening around there, I understand. Is that true?
Yes, they are. And they were happening well before this event. Our book contains, among other things, a National Security Agency report on a very famous event that actually was one that was singled out in Project Blue Book by the late, great Dr. James McDonald as one of the most important UFO cases of all time, and that was the 1956 Lincoln Heath, which is right in that area, UFO incident, which had some similarities, but it was air-to-air, ground-to-air, ground-to-air identification of unknowns going over that part of England at about 4,000 miles an hour. And in 1956, we didn't have much that did that, nothing I know about.
They went right over Bentwaters, actually, and were chased by jets, too, during that incident. They went right over the Bentwaters flight line. Those bases are all shut down now, and they film horror movies and a show called Top Gear, if you ever see that in the States, the English version sometimes, and Harry Potter. They make movies there constantly on Bentwaters. And some show called Space Camp. They have these idiots that thought they went to outer space in one of the bunkers. And then Dog Borstel, where you have bad dogs, and they go to dog prison in the weapon storage area. So,
I'll tell you another thing, Jerry. I think it was 92, 93, I forget, Larry, when we were down in Washington, D.C., and Charles Fault met with us, Fault being the former deputy base commander, at one point he asked me to turn off my tape recorder, and he told us some things off the record. I think he must have regretted it because he denies it now, but at one point he told us to our faces that the beams of light that these unknowns shone down into the weapons storage area somehow, those beams of light penetrated down to where the nuclear ordnance was stored, and his terminology adversely affected the ordnance. Now, again, he denies that now, but I'll go one-to-one with him on any lie detector.
Well,
I know Larry.
We of course, hear instances of this happening even in the States.
Absolutely.
In fact, one of the speakers at this conference, I think, has some experience in that.
Well, you got that right, and that is former United States Air Force Captain Robert Salas, who is a figure that Larry and I hold in tremendous respect and esteem. In 1968, the famous Malmstrom Air Force Base in the Midwest had a similar event, and Bob watched, I think, 8 nuclear weapons go offline as UFOs came in over the base. And he co-wrote a terrific book about it called Faded Giant, which should be in everybody's UFO library. And he'll be talking about that at the conference. These things happen. And there is a terrific book called UFOs and Nukes. It is the definitive book on the subject, written by the great UFO scholar Robert Hastings, and it's another book. I actually just got a copy, and I'm reading it right now. And it is the best compendium of all of the UFO nuclear-related events that we are actually aware of.
So, Larry, you then agree to the hypothesis that I have, personally, that the nuclear weapons probably had something to do with this Rendlesham thing, or do
well,
I not?
Well, I don't know that officially, but if I go on Colonel Holt said to us, you know, in D.C. in person, and then what I don't know if this is I believe it might be because I've heard one of the other witnesses mention that he corrected that in an email, and I'm just saying I've read this, and I saw this individual respond that that's an email he got from Holt saying they didn't affect them. He said they stole some of them.
They stole some of them.
This is what I've seen on their site, which is all that they've removed all that stuff. But it was some interaction with.
Peter, I wonder if any of the records of any other missing nuclear weapons have come up. You know, that's an interesting spinoff or idea or a different approach.
Yeah, I guess if there is something positive about this, when Hall stated that the UFOs adversely affected the ordnance, it was not adverse in the most adverse possible way, or there would be no England left to speak of, and if there was, everybody there would have three eyes, long tails, and talk in tongues, and be eating each other for lunch. It'd be zombie land. There's a tremendous amount of nuclear ordnance on this twin base complex, and the situation was beyond tense.
Well, we're talking with Larry Warren and Peter Robbins, and the book is Left of the East Gate, and it's still available, right? Every place, right? The new book version
until the end of time. Yes, the company that has the current edition out is Cosmo Press in New York, and you can find it on an ebook-related website.
Now, I have about 4 or 5 people in the chat room, and they're all asking the same question, Larry Warren, and it's always asked by everybody, including myself. Do you feel like you were selected? Basically, I'm summing up different questions, but they all want to know, like, why you? Were you a special person? Do you think it was just an accident of time, of space, that you were there?
No.
This happened, or what?
Right, okay, that's a fair question. There is a couple guys that think they're special. I don't. However, I think we were, maybe they are, I don't know. But I think, all I can say, I've had experiences with this subject matter since I was a child. And it does follow the bloodline because I'm a father and I understand this now even more disturbingly clearly with many of us. And this is since I was a kid. And I know another couple of witnesses just after these things happened said to me that they had things happen to them when they were young. And I said, well, I had these things. And I think a number of us there's some kind of tracking somewhere. I don't know where they. They put us in place for this, certain ones, and I think they wanted to see who would be predisposed to the subject matter in one form or another, in one way or another, and then to, I don't think I'm special. But I think I'm one tough SOB because I'm the one that got it out, and it needed to happen.
By happenstance, you may be the witness, but you're getting treated pretty raw by authorities who don't want the story out, and rather than doing their job, they're busy destroying witnesses and people trying to tell the truth. And then you've got this other level that maybe there is some sort of, your work with Bud Hopkins, Peter, kind of shows that. It travels in families and things. Abductions.
And Jerry, let me chime in here for one moment because I've got a moment here where real life has interceded with our interview. My nephew who graduated from Cornell yesterday, his birthday is tomorrow. So I'm going to now take 4 minutes, leave you guys alone while we light his cake, sing him happy birthday, and then I'm going to come back and address those issues.
Sounds good. And while you're gone, Larry Warren, why don't you do us a favor and tell us exactly what happened to you?
What happened to me, I got in the base December 1st. I'll go real quick. Who knows how many candles David has? Not as much as me. That's a quick candle. I got on the base in December 1. I had 2 weeks incoming training. I was put on to D-Flight, and I was off for 2 days leading up when the first two events happened, or first and one and a half events. Came back on to my shift, which started again. I think it was a Sunday night from what I'm seeing now. It was never quite clear on it. And went out to we get our weapons. I had PRP, and I'm emphasizing certain things for certain parties, and they know who they are. And I had the documentation, all that stuff. So anyway, and I got out on this very remote kind of end of Bentwaters runway. They were talking about the lights are back on the radios. And I didn't see anything, but I saw we had low fences then, these jack deer came running across our runway in front of me. There were no planes or anything, but it ran across my little sand pit there with the sandbags I was in. And then I got relieved from my post. I'm just going to put it in a nutshell. I got picked up. There was Lieutenant England in that truck. It was a security police pickup truck. I got in the back. There were other personnel. Sergeant Costanza was in the front seat driving. We went to the base motor pool. They actually called me from CSC, I'd imagine, and they said, deactivate, your post is deactivated. Go with Lieutenant England. Didn't know what we were doing, and I clearly remember this. We went to the motor pool. They were on Bentwaters. There was a lot of problems with the gauges and a lot of upset people running around. And if you read Georgina Brunei's book, there are technicians that were working in there that saw this activity go on and verifies what I said. We met other vehicles and got to the east end of RAF Woodbridge where they had lights, guys with flashlights and all this. And there was a girl, a woman with a little girl. This is where the memory is very clear. A little girl on the seat of the car, because they go in that back gate road sometimes at night. And they were holding her up, and we went by them, turned into the woods. It was, for me, it was in the 30s probably. It was a clear, moonless night. Halt verified that back in the 80s when I said I described the weather exactly what it was. We went down this trail. We stopped. There was something. The lighting equipment was there. It was not turned on. Then we broke up, and they took weapons off us, which is verified, and we went into the woods in small parties. Off to my left, at X amount of distance, I couldn't tell you now because the forest doesn't look like it did back then, and there was some activity, and I do believe that's where Colonel Holt was investigating a site in the forest.
Right, and that's probably when he was making that famous recording.
Well, that's when the tape would have been there because all those transmissions. John Burroughs was back in that parking area. There was other people in that parking area. He was off duty. He had been involved on the first night with Peniston and Cabanasac, and I think Bud Steffens was out there too.
Had you heard about what had happened to them before?
No. Not at all.
No, fresh in from a couple of days off. And
I had no idea about any of that. And all this stuff about rumors is not true at that point. And I never heard. Let me tell you, it's zip. The only person I told was my mother and then a couple guys we talked about in in our dorms very quietly. And we got out closer to this field called Capel Green. I didn't know what it was then. I didn't know about the Orford Lighthouse. I didn't even know what that forest was called. It was just the woods to me because we go by it every day going to Woodbridge to go to classes. And out in this field was this mist on the ground. The farmer's house is off to the left at about X amount of yards. I don't say the exact number because if I'm off a foot, that will be cannon fodder for certain parties. I don't know. It's off to the left, and there was a light on the upper floor on the right. There was a dog barking incessantly. There were two cows in that field. And there's a story about the cows getting hit by a car. I can't verify. I don't know if that's true. They weren't there suddenly. And every motion seemed slowly. Your thought process seemed slow at half speed, is my impression looking back. Very dreamlike, all of this. The radios were going crazy, and in the distance south of where the Orford Lighthouse would be, I never noticed the lighthouse at all or a pinprick, and I know that would very well nowadays, but back then I didn't know where I was. Mm-hmm. It was very dark, and this thing lit up, this giant oak tree. I could see it's still there. I use it as a marker, and right in the spot between this outcropping of trees, which turns out now that's where the first night guys end up having contact, where Colonel Holt says nothing happened in my side of the field, and now everything happens over there. You know, you stick around long enough, it all works out, I guess. But this mist was on the ground. You could see the ground through it. It was transparent. It was greenish-yellow kind of mist. and it was not ground fog. It was, even though it's indigenous, people come up with all their theories and
so what do you think this mist was coming from? Where was it? Just coming up out of the ground?
It was a defined shape about 50 feet across, and it was a defined about a foot off. It didn't hover off the ground. It was attached to the ground, rose up about a foot. And then over that stand of trees where the other guys from the first night now say they encountered, which I believe, they touched the object and all that, this red light came, an amber light.
Did you see the object?
Oh, yeah.
Can you describe it to us?
Well, there wasn't anything there other than this mist, and then this red light was way out in the distance toward the sea. I didn't know the sea was out there, but this light came in, arced over the field. It did a U shape, stopped over this mist really close to everybody, and just explosion of light. I got flash burns to my retinas from this. It was all documented when I was on that base. I stole the medical records. I have them still. They're in a book. They're authentic. They are what they are. I stole them. And sorry. And I knew I had to, and a base lawyer said you should. So I did, not knowing what I'd ever do with them. And this object was there. Again, my describing this is just for time's sake. If the reality of it is so different than what I could put in write or describe, really, so it comes off like a B movie, and it isn't that way. And there were cameras photographing this phenomena because obviously they knew this stuff was going on. And I know Sergeant Nevels, who was the photographer, he would have been out with Holt there, but there were other people documenting this. This is why I think there were observers that knew this stuff was happening. And I saw that going on, and this was filmed as...
Wait a minute. The observers, you're talking about them maybe our troops or military or personnel?
Yeah, I would have thought they were military. Yeah, I didn't know. I don't know who they were. But if you listen on the Holt tape, the British police, who deny they were ever there, the Holt tape, and no one picks this up, man, at all. Our police sirens sounded like they do in America. You know, back then in England, they had that classic kind of sound. If you listen on the Holt tape really well, you hear the Suffolk Constabulary arrive out there because they had the rollers go, and you hear it on that tape, and it's there. And you know, people got their own agendas and what, and just ignore that; it's there. And they came.
Yeah, we're gonna close the show with that Holt tape.
It's an important thing. It's totally real. I'm the guy, you know, that was given to me by the Japanese, and they said, don't do anything with that, because they got it from a Sam Morgan on our base who didn't believe in UFOs anyway, and maybe sold it to him. I don't know. I know Holt's furious about it. But then when the Japanese passed that tape to me, they said, oh, don't do anything with it, as if I wouldn't. And I ran back to the States and gave it to CNN right away, and that's how it got out to the wide public. I got that. I gave that out.
I knew something about that. I didn't know.
Oh, absolutely, man. The whole tape, the document got out because of me. You know, I get credit for that stuff. Now I want to, because I'm the one that put my ass on the line. All these guys collected their pensions for years, and that's fine. That's cool. But I laid it out, man. This was not an easy thing. And they think I'm some crazy biker, and they want to create all their kind of thing. Let me tell you what. I've worked in professions they couldn't even get near the door at all. And I'm very proud of my life, and I have all the faults everyone else does. What I saw happen, and it's been altered in some way, but the crux of it is this object exploded. There was a different object there, or it was always there. It was perception now. It had no. It was a triangular thing. It was quite large, white-ish color, rainbow colors on it. And there was a life form associated with it. At one point, it was photographed, seen. I saw it, and there was something in these blue lights it had features and faces and bodies, and they were small. Were they ET? I don't know what it was, because a guy next to me said, do you see those kids? And that, I swear to God, he said that. And he finally, this guy, which
now they
captain,
were outside of the craft or what?
Yeah, there were three things there, and it was all in light, and it all split up, and you could, as it faded out, you could see this stuff, and how I knew it's alive, and again, it's like a dream looking at this, feels dreamlike. I still remember it, and it was, it moved. I mean, independent, and there were senior people there, and, you know, I think everyone's gotten their eggs scrambled so much. If you talk to one guy and talk to the next that were right there with him, like on that first night, if you go to the original statements, none of them matches. None of them remember that guy next to him. I've got guys who are right next to me that verified, except held back on certain things. And that's where all these people say I changed my story and all that. I got dudes that were right with me that have said just about the same deal, other than the shape of things or whatever. And, you know, at the end of the day, I don't have to be right. I just know it was right and it was there, and it left evidence exactly where I said. When I went back there 8 years later with Peter, I said it was right there. And then we did all this soil analysis and all this stuff through Springborn Environmental Labs, and it came back anomalous. I mean, in that one space, man, you know, so it happened, and that was only one part, a small part of this big thing. I got called away, went back to the base. I'm really condensing it. It's only one chapter in our book. It got back
to
the base.
How did they treat you when you got back to the base after seeing this? Did you get any...
there were some guys saying little green men stuff on the flights. You know, the thing is, this would have been about 1 in the morning or 2, and it was close to daylight getting back, but it doesn't seem like I was there long at that event. I look at that nowadays and say, where did the morning come so quick? But the first thing we did, we didn't get debriefed, any of that kind of thing. We turned in our weapons. We have armors. And some of us are being pulled out. New flights were going on, the day flight, whoever that was now. And I went back to my room, and I felt like I walked literally from the flight line. I didn't take the bus back. And walked back and got in my room, and I had a metallic taste in my mouth. My eyes were burning and watering. And I went to breakfast, and that's when I ran into one of the witnesses. And two of us were at the breakfast at the security police table, and one of them said to me, "What the F was that all about?" And freaked out because some guys were melting down, you know. And the other person who's well known is at the end of the table and told me to shut the F up, who wasn't there that night but was there at the table. And so, and that's not denied, that's in my book and in our book. And at the end of the day, I'm not being cryptic here. I just don't want to get into wars with these people. Let them fight their own wars. For God's sake, I've been doing it 30 years. The end of the day, I ran and took another guy, Greg Batram, from St. Louis, who saw parts of these events. I see they attack him now, too. You know, Band of Brothers don't exist in this thing, trust me. And I called my mother. And the first person I chose to lie to was my own mother, within hours of this event. I'm making a joke with that. And I called my mom. I reversed the charges, and she's still with us. She's 80, but I said, or 79, she killed me. And I said, you know, man, I just saw a UFO. You won't believe this. And we got cut off. And literally the operator, I called her back, and she said, "Are you calling from the base?" And I said, "Yes." And she goes, "You were cut off on the base." And that is the moment I was on SHIT Street, right at that moment, because they had me. They played the tape back later on, and then they were able to manipulate me quite a few ways. You see, you look back, you can do this with very young, naive soldiers or airmen. You can do that with young kids. People who live a little bit of life, they're not going to buy into that garbage, and they're going to see a rat when there's a rat, and there were a lot of rats on that base. And there were a lot more rats after the event, and there were people put in to spot and watch people. And see, I saw one lieutenant go off, literally pulled a belt knife out, and I'll tell you what, I won't say her name, who had a really heavy experience, right to this, we had a major, not Major Ziegler, it was Major Drury, because she refused to do a certain duty. I was right in that office because of this phenomenon and all and what happened to her. By that night, heavy stuff went down, and myself, another guy, and a number of other people apparently got really dealt with, man, and that went on for a couple days, and there's verification. I was missing for a few people looking for me for a few days, and they said I was on temporary leave. I was there, and probably in the security wing with these other people, and a couple will be real surprised to find out what I know now. And boy, they bad things went on. See, if people listen to this stuff, think it's like science fiction, all this stuff. This stuff went on way before X-Files and all that. And these events, you know, people have tried to, even the UFO pro-research community and some of these guiding lights of this stuff, you know, try to come out and, you know, have attacked this or attacked me or attacked the events in general. And, you know, a lot of them have come and gone, man. We're still here. And we'll always be here. And then if we're not here, our kids will do it. Because it's real. And this event scares the living hell out of the powers that be. It definitely does. I mean, in Syria, you got that guy, the medical doctor that runs that country, murdering children, six-year-old kids, cutting their throats. And we got things we got to deal with in this messed up world. But this thing, man, they'd rather millions of kids get killed than this stuff come out, man. That's how nice these folks are that are able to be the custodians of this information. I don't think they have a right to do that or keep it. It's all of us. I'll shut up.
Well, and you've been through a lot, Larry, and I agree.
Yeah, but I'm in a good
place.
They don't have a right to.
It seems to me that they spend more time on trying to cover these things up than. Then
I think people are onto it in this world. You know, when I went public years ago, I mean, I didn't want people I worked with knowing about it. When I filmed CNN's special assignment back in 84, I always think of this because my dad was on, I was in my dad's backyard in Connecticut, and he was out in the back porch. He goes, don't let him film the goddamn house. I'll never forget my family went through all this stuff, and I'm certain all the other guys, including my arch nemesises, they all, you know, with their family, they all suffer too, these guys. I mean, you know, I do support them. They drive me insane. I've never been incensed by people more than them. But I do support them. I know they went through stuff. And I just find the dynamic going on nowadays really, really sad, man. You know, because they're, not them, not us. The people pulling the strings are winning. And they continue to win as long as we do the dance of doom and chase our tails. And that's what we're doing. It's a shame.
I wonder if Peter's back from his birthday sing-along.
Oh, yeah. I've been back for a while, Jerry. And I'd like to jump in here and just give you an example of some of what I came into dovetailing with Larry's experiences. We go back to the area for the very first time together in February of 88. A few days into our week, we walk out to this field, this farmer's field, where Larry and the men he was with had their experience. I know where I'm going. I've been studying this now for 5 months. I've been reading everything I can find, stuff Larry's provided to me, recording him, questioning him, re-questioning him, and we're getting to that point where the forest kind of breaks and you can see the field. I knew Larry was kind of tense, understandably. He hadn't been back to that exact spot since it had happened on that night. And I'm recording this as it's happening. And this is important for an investigator. And as the field opens up, his arm literally automatically shoots out. And I've got all this on tape. And it points right to the spot. And he says, it sat right there. Then he's quiet for a moment. And then he says words to the effect of, but of course, it's a coincidence that that area that I'm pointing to where it's sat is discolored and doesn't look like the rest of the field. Well, my first thought was not, oh, my God, look, there's the spot where the UFO sat 8 years later and you can still see it. I don't investigate like that. I thought, yeah, that is a coincidence. Maybe it's a play of light. Maybe lightning hit that area. Maybe a farmer dumped fertilizer there and didn't grade it out. Ultimately, we spent a few hours in the field. I kept looking back at it. Larry, too, it did look different. Finally pulled some samples, a little film canister, went out into the field, got some other samples. They looked different. They felt different. To cut to the chase, and a year and a half later, I return on my own after consulting with an analytical laboratory in Massachusetts, very good one that Larry mentioned. They had supplied me with quart containers, and I came back with about 20 pounds of dirt in these containers, carefully marked, affected area, edge of affected area, control sample A, control sample C. These things were professionally analyzed, and we'll be presenting these results again at the conference. several extraordinary things. Number one, the sand content in the soil. I'm only 6 miles or so from the sea there, so you'd expect there to be some sand in the soil. Absolutely normal in the control samples. In the affected area, the sand was melted. The pH was blown out of the soil. You couldn't get it to hold moisture well. It took longer for seed germinations to take place in the affected sample, and every one they were able to produce only came up in a mutant strain. There was more than four times the amount of tiny macroscopic little bits of metal that you'd normally find occurring in the soil, suggesting to our soil analyst, Mr. Matthew Moniz, who has remained a good friend over the decades, that an electromagnetic effect exerted such pull in that area that it produced that effect. He said also as far as the sand being in an interim form of glass, it was something they couldn't even reproduce in the laboratory. Now, that's physical evidence when combined with the firsthand testimony, other testimonies, a previous history in the area, the photographs of the area, quite mind-boggling. Even 9.5 years later, you see this giant green ellipse in an entirely yellow field because it took longer to grow. And that is not a psychological operation. That is not mind control. That's not time travelers from the future. That is physical effects of a genuine event.
We are almost out of time, but let's talk quickly about the conference, where it's being held. And I know it goes different from our conferences. I think you have something going on as late as 10 o'clock at night.
Well, absolutely. We're going to 11:30 at night, and the doors open at 10. Let me give you a quick rundown here, and anybody that might be able to come, please have a pencil handy. It's going to be the 17th of June. It's going to be only £20 all day. The speakers are Alan Godfrey, the legendary British police officer who was involved in an extraordinary UFO event a month before Rendlesham and suffered tremendously for his courage in coming forward. Timothy Good, for me, the preeminent UFO researcher in the United Kingdom and author. Captain Robert Salas, who we've discussed previously, discussing his UFO nuclear event. Larry, bless his heart, is going to be emceeing the entire thing and on stage with me at least part of the time answering questions and I'm sure having his say. Gary Hazeltine, the serving British police detective, who is put together a tremendous database in the UK of police sightings and is quite knowledgeable on Rendlesham. Myself, a colleague named Jennifer Stein, a good friend who is one of our best American crop circle people, and she's going to be speaking on crop circles in America to a British audience. I've seen the presentation. It's absolutely sensational. And Sasha Christie, an experiencer, abductee, who is very involved in research with folks and working with people who have had experiences. It is going to be one not to be missed. You can find information about it on the Rendlesham Forest 2012 conference website, which is rendleshamufo.com, or go to our Facebook page. Tickets are selling now. We really hope to see a bunch of you there. I'm so happy I'm going to be back with my friend, my soul brother, and my co-author Larry Warren, and so many other friends in England, and having a week to warm up in France first.
Larry Warren, I'm going to give you a chance to close things out. First of all, we need to plug that book. The correct title is?
Yeah, that's Left at
Eastgate. First-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation, Cosimo Press, the 2005 edition.
And we have a link to that and to the website for the conference as well on our pages.
Yeah, if you would, Jerry, that would be great. And again, that's rendleshamufo.com.
Yep. Larry, did we give you a chance to bring out everything you need to bring out, or you have something?
You know, it's good. I don't do these a lot, but it's great to talk to you, finally meet you on the radio, and it's an honor. I love your show, and all my friends in the States may be listening, you know, love to you all, and I'm in a good place. I'm the dad of a great guy, a son who's as tall as me now, and I learn from him every day. And without Rendlesham in our book, I wouldn't have him because I met his mom on our book tour. So it all ended up good for me.
Thank both of you for taking the time, and we'll talk to you after the conference, both of you. We've got to stay in touch, and I'd love to be able to broadcast that recording.
It's an honor.
Will do. And, Jerry, all the best to you and my friends in Oklahoma, and we will be in touch with you, and I'll be back to you before then with the follow-up information.
Okay, thanks to both of you for covering UFO secrets tonight on the Jerry Piven UFO Show.
Extraordinary music career spanning over 30 years. Composer and multi-instrumentalist Janus has delighted us with his UFO-themed works. From his exploration of the Roswell crash with his 1998 award-winning album, to his sonic journeys at the Kenneth Arnold incident, the Rendlesham story, and beyond. All available music by Janus can be found at his official music website. Go to janus.soundfuturesdirect.com. Janus, expanding the frontiers of music and the history of ufology.